My name is Gail Eifrig, and this is a session in the series of sessions that I'm doing about feasting, particularly as feasting is demonstrated for us by literary texts. And I think that it's very true that you probably know as many of those or more to fill in the list that I have provided. These were sort of some of my quick thoughts, and then some thoughts as I worked on it more, just to kind of fill out this list. Some of you have the handout, and some of you I've asked to share because I made very few of them.
And what is your background? We didn't get that.
Oh, well, see, I was told to hurry through these sessions and not do all the introductory stuff that one. And I always follow instructions. I'm a professor of English at Valparaiso University. And at Valparaiso, I usually teach what I call reading and writing, just in a variety of settings. I teach composition, both for freshmen, and I also teach advanced composition in the English department. For the last 6 years, the largest part of my job has been editing a journal that Valparaiso University publishes called The Crescent. So that's the biggest part of my job, editing The Crescent, which means a lot of writing and reading and writing to people and talking to people about their writing. What else do I do? For the last, 7 years ago on a sabbatical, I had been increasingly interested in some recent kinds of study of biblical narratives. So I don't like to call it Bible as literature because that tends to identify a way of studying the Bible as though it were not a sacred text, but, you know, just people who talk about, oh, it's a book like any other great book, so, you know, we just look at it that way. There is a kind of school of more current biblical scholarship, which is both highly faithful and uses the full range of scholarship in both literary and biblical scholarship senses. And so I was interested in working some more with that. And I had a sabbatical, which I took at the University of Chicago in the Divinity School, and I studied Hebrew and biblical narrative. Come on in. Is this the one you mean to be in? This is... Well, I saw this room last night, and I thought, well, all my people are there. You'll be reimagining, but as Anne and I said to each other, we thought we could actually meet in the same room, because certainly my vision for this session is that we Christians, and especially I think sacramentally active Lutherans, for whom the Eucharistic feast is an important and a significant part of our faith life. We do it so often, and I don't mean to say we should go back to four times a year by any means, but the thoughts about the feast and the Eucharistic feast have become so familiar to us that maybe there are some things about feasting that we could recover or even reimagine. If we look at feasting as it has been demonstrated and celebrated and shown and written about by writers. And so I just picked out a number of pieces of text that I thought had interesting things to say and sometimes provocative things to show us about the nature of feasting. And I don't mean then in this session that we have to make all those connections between the feastings that are displayed here in this literature and the feasts that we celebrate in our weekly worship, and then the feast that we expect as that we are now having the foretaste of. Those connections are not maybe necessarily the subject of this session, but I would hope that those get going in your mind and set up some reverberations that those of us who are here on Sunday night when we partake of the Eucharistic feast here will maybe have some different things going in our minds as we think about, feasting, and what is this feast that we say we are engaged in. So my list, and some of you have a copy of this, and some of you just have to fly blind or find somebody else to share with because I made so few of them, following all of Holden's restrictions about how you shouldn't have any paper.
Yeah, we were late. We were down. So no, this is right.
It's not bad. Not late. Is this where you mean to be? You don't mean to be next door. Oh, okay. Just want to give everyone a chance to escape. My first session theme was community, and we really started off with a section from the text that I intend to use all through these 10 sessions that I have planned, The Wind and the Willows, and the bookstore man tells me there are still copies of this, so some of you have not done what you should do and gone out and bought this. I do think that it is a wonderfully charming book with all its limitations of time and place, its sort of stuffy British aristocratic or pseudo-aristocratic view of the world, but it also has a charm that is strong still. And I think for people who are in this setting, where we have an opportunity to reimagine ourselves in relationship to nature or the natural world, Wind in the Willows has some marvelous passages about the natural world. They tend to be a bit, they're Edwardian. I think you have to, if you like those Merchant Ivory films like Howard's End and what was the other one? No, there was Where Angels Fear to Tread and more recently, The Remains of the Day. That sort of prose and that sort of view of the world, you can maybe enjoy the prose. But Wind in the Willows has some wonderful things. And we did something with community in a feasting scene in this book to start with. And then the next, or Monday night, was we saw Babette's Feast, because the other book, the other literary text, which I intend to keep weaving through this whole 10 sessions, is Babette's Feast, and so we'll keep coming back to that a number of times, and that is also in the bookstore. The other texts that I want to bring into what we're thinking about here are in this handout, so that if you read something and then pass it on to somebody else to read, that's fine. They are just little snippets, really little bits and pieces from these mostly larger works. And it's a couple of those that I want to get to. We've had to collapse a couple of sessions because we talked about Babette's Feast in the night that we were going to talk about intimacy. So I want to talk tonight about both the themes of intimacy and abundance. And that's a lot of text. If you're looking on the front page of my handout, you can see that for intimacy, I had put down Tom Jones and The Eve of St. Agnes, which is a big 18th century novel by Henry Fielding, and the long romantic poem by John Keats, The Eve of St. Agnes. And for abundance, I had put down The Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens, The Wedding at Cana, which I assume is familiar, and also some sections of Pickwick Papers, which are great fun, but which I did not reproduce. I did, however, do the section from Tom Jones, little bitty section. Some people may remember a scene in the movie Tom Jones. If you ever saw Tom Jones, that scene in the movie sort of sticks in your memory. It is a kind of love or seduction scene. I don't think it's seduction because they're both interested in the outcome. And it happens over a meal. It happens as they are sharing food. And what the film director has done is to show us the eating in a way that becomes more than eating and certainly becomes intimate as the two of them share this meal. the little section from the handout I think we ought to get to later, because I really want to introduce intimacy with this scene from Wind in the Willows. I had said last time, talked a little bit about the plot in Wind in the Willows and how the very earliest thing that happens in this book is that Mole, who is a very homebound sort of creature, on the first pages of the book, doing his house cleaning, becomes overcome with this desire to run off and be a part of a larger world, experience something new and different. And since he couldn't go to Holden, he runs off to the river. And there at the river, he meets Ratty, the water rat, who represents a whole different kind of life and the excitement and adventure of this. Very early then, on that first encounter, Rat asks him if he'd like to go on a picnic. This is, Mole is quite overcome by this. He's not used to this kind of wild living represented by picnics. Rat says, well, let's go up the river in the boat. Says Mole, I've never been in a boat in all my life. What? Cried the rat. Never? What have you been doing? He says. And the mole asks if it's that nice, and Rat says, yes, it is wonderful. So very, very shortly then, as this wonderful and really sort of the precipitating event, as literature teachers like to say in the book, is this picnic on the river that the two animals take together. And one of them is introducing the other to the whole idea of this, and also, I think, to the idea of friendship. Ratty says, look here, if you've really... This one is... It won't leave me alone.
I feel sorry for you, but it's just one fly. Why don't you just let it land on you and kill it?
Because it's going in my mouth.
Hi, Eric, we're a rescuer.
Yes, I'll probably...
Do you want me to nail that one for you?
Only if I have a fencing mask, probably. All right, I shall try not to disturb you by whacking at it. The mole waggled his toes.
It's dead.
I appreciate it. Okay, well, I'll rely on the more natural people to do that for me. Okay, so they're about to go down the river for this picnic. Mole waggled his toes from sheer happiness, spread his chest with a sigh of full contentment, and leaned back blissfully into the soft cushions. What a day I'm having, he said. Let us start at once. Hold hard a minute, then, said the rat. He looped the painter through a ring in his landing stage, climbed up into his hole above, and after a short interval, reappeared, staggering under a fat wicker luncheon basket. Shove that under your feet, he observed to the mole as he passed it down into the boat. Then he untied the painter and took the skulls again. What's inside it? Asked the mole, wiggling with curiosity. There's cold chicken inside it, replied the rat briefly. Cold tongue, cold ham, cold beef, pickled gherkins, salad, French rolls, cress, one with sandwiches, potted meat, ginger beer, lemonade, soda water. Oh, stop, stop, cried the mole in ecstasies. This is too much. Well, part of the charm of that is that it, you know, hardly seems like too much, this picnic. And yet it is, notice, it's the effect on mole that it has that makes it, that gives it its essential quality. The quality of being provided for and all the rest of what is happening is too much. Do you really think so? Inquired the rat seriously. It's only what I always take on these little excursions, and the other animals are always telling me that I'm a mean beast and cut it very fine. The mole never heard a word he was saying. Absorbed in the new life he was entering upon, intoxicated with the sparkle, the ripple, the scents, and the sounds, and the sunlight, he trailed a paw in the water and dreamed long waking dreams. The water rat, like the good little fellow he was, sculled steadily on and forbore to disturb him. Well, they go, there's some more wonderful stuff about the river and about a couple of creatures on the river. But finally, Ratty says, "Here's our backwater at last, where we're going to lunch." Leaving the mainstream, they now passed into what had seemed at first sight like a little landlocked lake. Green turf sloped down to either edge. Brown, snaky tree roots gleamed below the surface of the quiet water, while ahead of them, the silvery shoulder and foamy tumble of a weir, arm in arm with a restless, dripping mill wheel that held up in its turn a gray gabled mill house, filled the air with a soothing murmur of sound, dull and smothery, yet with a little clear voices speaking up cheerfully out of it at intervals. It was so very beautiful that the mole could only hold up both forepaws and gasp, "Oh my, oh my, oh my," which is sort of the way I felt the first 3 days I was in Holden. I would start coming down from my chalet and look and just stand there saying, "Oh my, oh my, oh my." That was a kind of expansion of feasting because of the natural world itself. So they swing out the picnic basket. Mole begged as a favor to be allowed to unpack it all by himself, and the rat was very pleased to indulge him and to sprawl at full length on the grass and rest while his excited friend shook out the tablecloth and spread it, took out all the mysterious packets one by one and arranged their contents in due order, still gasping, oh my, at each fresh revelation. When all was ready, the rat said, "Now pitch in, old fellow," and the mole was indeed very glad to obey, for he had started his spring cleaning at a very early hour that morning, as people will do, and had not paused for bite or sup, and he'd been through a very great deal since that distant time which now seemed so many days ago. That's the beginning of their picnic, and other things happen as they talk, and Rat continues to tell Mole about this new world. "Well, well," said the rat, "I suppose we ought to be moving. I wonder which of us had better pack the luncheon basket." He did not speak, as if he was frightfully eager for the treat. "Oh, please let me," said the mole, so of course the rat let him. Packing the basket was not quite such pleasant work as unpacking the basket. It never is. But the mole was bent on enjoying everything, and although just when he had got the basket packed and strapped up tightly, he saw a plate staring up at him from the grass, and when the job had been done again, the rat pointed out a fork, which anybody ought to have seen, and last of all, behold, the mustard pot, which he'd been sitting on without knowing it. Still, somehow, the thing got finished at last without much loss of temper. And so they go back to their home, and that's really the end of that feast, which is I suppose it's stretching it a bit. It's not at all the same kind of feast as happens later in Dulce Domum, the chapter we read before. But it has, I think about it, that quality of intimacy in a feast. This is a feast not with a community, but with just two characters. And yet many of the qualities that I think we would identify with feasting are there, certainly because of the way that it strikes the mole. And it seems to me an interesting example that here, I guess there's not a complete mutuality in those two characters. That is, they're not both experiencing it the same way. For Ratty, it's what I always do when I go out, you know. For Mole, it's a whole new world of excitement over this this meal and all that it means to him. Even the friendship, even eating with another person as he's doing, is a completely wonderful and exciting, a new thing to him. So that it has, I think, all the qualities of feast. Anything that occurs to you as you heard that session, that little section? Feasting commentary?
If we have the feast the same way, the same way, the same way, year after year, month after month, and so forth, then all of a sudden the form changes, and we all of a sudden are looking at it from a different angle, different perspective. There's a lot to be said for some change, and therefore getting us to be more introspective and seek enjoyment for us.
So it is the mole's unfamiliarity with what is happening here that makes it so wonderful for him. It opens up something he hadn't suspected. could be there or could be available.
And to the rat, it was just the same thing.
It's ordinary to him.
Well, I think the rat, though, was enjoying moles
introducing it.
Enjoyment and something that he felt was ordinary to him, he could see someone else enjoying so much and probably, or maybe, thereby his enjoyment was increased.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think that's part of the intimacy quality. This shared meal, which is abundant in some respect, has a particular quality that that would not be there, even though they're not experiencing the same thing, the sense that one is introducing to the other is a nice point. It is, and the rat takes pleasure from seeing what is happening to his new friend in that environment. I wonder whether you will hear the same things in a couple of other of the feasts that we're going to look at. Just because I think it's sort of amusing in this context, maybe more than anything else, to look at the passage from the Eve of St. Agnes, which on the handout is on page 5. I always think of this as one of the most, I can remember still reading this as a college student when I was almost perpetually hungry. And this is one of the passages that used to make me feel even poorer and hungrier. I have since taught this in a very different light. I think it's a rather peculiar poem, much more peculiar than the way I was taught it. I mean, than the way I was taught it suggested. But this is in the middle of this very romantic poem in which the knight from far away comes to the dark, black, cold castle. And in the dark, black, cold castle, where he is an enemy and he is not supposed to be, he is there because he wants to entice away from this cold, dark, black castle Madeline, the beautiful young woman. Our hero's name is Porphyro. I'm not sure that ever... Oh, yeah, it does come up in here. He does a peculiar thing. There's a banquet going on, a dance in the castle. And this is on St. Agnes Eve, when the folk tradition is that if a maiden goes to bed not looking backward and not looking in a mirror or some other kinds of odd things, she will dream of the man she is to marry. Now, Porphyro has stolen to the castle, and he is in grave danger, and he has hidden himself away in Madeline's bedroom in a big cupboard. This is kind of comic in a way, but as a great height of romanticism document, it also is taking itself quite seriously. But Porphyro has come to this castle, and he's come to Madeline's bedroom because this is the moment where he wants to entice her to come away with him. And what does Porphyro bring to this endeavor as he's in this life and death situation where he wants desperately to get this beautiful young woman to come away from him and risk everything in order to come with him? He comes, she goes to bed following all the ritual properly, and then she gets into bed and she's lying there with her eyes closed. And as she's lying there and going off to sleep and in this sort of semi-dream state, then the poem switches again to Porphyro. Then by the bedside where the faded moon made a dim silver twilight, soft he set a table. And half anguished threw thereon a cloth of woven crimson, gold, and jet. Oh, for some drowsy morphian amulet. The boisterous midnight festive clarion, the kettle drum, and far-heard clarinet affray his ears, though but in dying tone. The hall door shuts again, and all the noise is gone. Here he's in this dark part of the castle, and someone opens the door, and he hears the sounds of that festival coming up the corridor, and it's closed. And still she slept in azure-lidded sleep, in blanched linen, smooth and lavendered, while he from forth the closet brought a heap of candied apple, quince, and plum, and gourd, with jellies soother than the creamy curd, and lucent syrups tinct with cinnamon, manna and dates in argosy transferred from Fez, and spiced dainties every one from silken Samarkand to cedared Lebanon. Now, I should make you go through that and read it. Those of you who have a copy in front of you, let us read that stanza, because it makes your mouth move, right? And you are supposed to, as your mouth moves, and this is Keats's idea, recapitulate the movement of your mouth in actually tasting. The words are, they're not repetitions of sound, which onomatopoeia would be, but it's repetitions of the motions of mouth in eating. So that if you read this and you make yourself do it, you will have those, that experience. All right? And still she slept in azure-lidded sleep, in blanched linen, smooth and lavendered, while he from forth the closet brought a heap of candied apple, quince, and plum, and gourd, with jellies soother than the creamy curd, and lucent syrups tinct with cinnamon, manna and dates in argosy transferred from Fez, and spiced dainties every one from silken Samarkand to cedared Lebanon. The original bedroom picnic, which Porphyro expects to be the ultimate, come on, no, that she will not be able to escape the lure of this. These delicates he heaped with glowing hand on golden dishes and in baskets bright of wreathed silver. Sumptuous they stand in the retired quiet of the night, filling the chilly room with perfume light. And now, my love, my seraph fair, awake. Thou art my heaven, and I thy eremite. Open thine eyes for meek St. Agnes' sake, or I shall drowse beside thee, so my soul doth ache. Wow. Thus whispering, his warm, unnerved arm sank in her pillow. Shaded was her dream by the dusk curtains. 'Twas a midnight charm impossible to melt as iced stream. The luscious salvers in the moonlight gleam. Broad golden fringe upon the carpet lies. It seemed he never, never could redeem from such a steadfast spell his lady's eyes. So mused awhile and toiled in woofed fantasies. Well, the food itself and the smell of the food as it warms in the room. And there's quite a bit that Keats makes in this poem of the wonderful difference between the cold environment and this warm woman and the in the bed in front of him, and then his warm passion. But there's one more element of feasting which he has not got there yet, although he has all this gorgeous, very exotic food, beautiful, expensive. Notice that all those things, they're imported food, so they're all, and they're preserved. They're not natural food. They're all somehow enhanced by expense and just that the old woman who lives in the castle, who has helped get him there, has probably brought him these things from the castle. I hate to think of Porphyro, you know, galloping over this great distance in the cold, carrying all this whole, not even the table setting and the tablecloth and all. But now there's this another element of feasting, which he now brings, awakening up. And he's been there sort of dozing next to her on the pillow. This is highly erotic 19th century poetry. Awakening up, he took her hollow lute, tumultuous, and in chords that tenderest be, he played an ancient ditty long since mute, in Provence called La Belle Dame sans Merci, close to her ear, touching the melody. Wherewith disturbed, she uttered a soft moan. He ceased, she panted quick, and suddenly her blue, afraid eyes wide open shone. Upon his knees he sank, pale as smooth sculptured stone. Now she wakes up and thinks she still must be dreaming. Presumably the man she has been dreaming of is he, and then she wakes up and there he is. And this, when she wakes up, she then has to kind of bring him to life again, as she sees him and he looks cold in this moonlight, and how pallid, chill, and drear. She says, "Give me that voice again, my Porphyro, those looks immortal, those complainings dear. Oh, leave me not in this eternal woe, for if thou diest, my love, I know not where to go." At this moment, then, there is this kind of union, which, because this is the 19th century, is not a sexual union as such, but certainly shortly after this this section, the two of them ride off together. She does go with him off into the darkness, and they escape this terrible castle where her relatives have kept her on ice, as it were, for this till this time in her life. And the feast that is in this poem is, it seems to me, central. It's not only, it's central spatially in a way. This section is the very middle of the poem. He's in the middle of the castle. This is a central moment. He says very little to her. He does not, we don't get in this poem a long speech from him to her about how she ought to come away with him. What he does to win her is to be there, to spread this feast in the room, which, so far as I can tell from the poem, neither of them ever eats or tastes, literally. They smell it. I think that Keats has this wonderful insight here that when you put out and into a warm room this bunch of fruit and jelly and good stuff like that, it makes, and he even uses some of those spices when he talks about the cinnamon and the syrup and so forth. Those, that makes this wonderful smell, and that in itself, along with the sound of the lute and his voice singing this ancient song to her, those things are what is the communication between them at this moment. He doesn't tell her, you know, what his 401k plan is, or, you know, he doesn't outline their future in any kind of terms at all, even romantic 19th century ones. The communication that he offers is this feast which he spreads out in front of her. And then he wakes her with music to the feast and the sight and the smell of it. And then that communication represents what happens between them, and they escape into the night. I mean, it certainly is not realistic. It is the ultimate fantasy. And the way I teach this now, this poem, is very much in the context of teaching it as the kind of the ultimate male fantasy. We don't have to go into that. But it is interesting to me that in this case, Keats has a man put this feast in front of a woman as an attractive device, as a thing to move her toward him. And it is its gorgeousness and its beauty and presumably its sort of extravagance the unexpected. I mean, I don't imagine Madeline waking up and saying, oh my, oh my, oh my, oh my, like Mole. But I think maybe that some of the sense of her being completely taken by surprise and swept away by something so magical, unexpected, something like a dream feast, which has become real in front of her. And that fantastical becoming reality moves her to do the thing which she hadn't expected to be able to do. She had only dreamed of it, and now it becomes an actuality. And off they go into the midnight, out into the snow. So it's not your usual feast, I think, but one that occurs to me maybe because I've always found that stanza where the food is described to be such a powerfully evocative literary presentation of food. What other things do you notice in the passage? Anything strike you?
It evokes the senses. I guess that would be just sight and sound.
And sound. And smell, which is very important in it. And not something you ordinarily find in literature somehow. Mm-hmm. We may hit that again in Christmas Carol, because it was very important to Dickens.
The interesting thing is that, at least in this book's here, she did not partake of the feast.
No, neither of them does, I think. Unless we would think that to recognize the accept the feast, the smell and the look of the feast, is partaking of it in some sense. And I think for Keats, as a sort of frustrated erotic romantic poet, there is probably in this poem a strong suggestion of the unfulfilled. Which is characteristically romantic. I mean, the romantic would almost rather have a desire unfulfilled than to have it fulfilled and become prosaic. I mean, that's almost the definition of a romantic, who enjoys the longing more than the satisfaction. And here I think that Keats's portrayal of this uneaten banquet is part of what makes it so much itself. It wouldn't be the way a movie director today would put this scene in front of us. Our culture is really not big on unfulfilled desire. But for Keats, it is tremendously powerful. And I think he has Madeline respond to that untasted. But somehow, she has taken it in some way, though she hasn't eaten it.
Woman's viewpoint, I think it's very powerful. I mean, I don't know about me. I think I can speak for many women, find it tremendously sensuous to have a man prepare a meal for you, because it's not an unusual thing.
Okay.
For many women.
So part, yes, and that is the sense here of this. There's something that makes this almost too easy for him after, when he's done this. She can, you know, she has no defenses against that action.
But the beauty of the meal, mm-hmm. the way it's laid out, and his description of it, if indeed she sees it as is described, she is taking that in mm-hmm. almost as much as he can.
And does the beauty here remind you in the film of Babette's Feast, when we walk into the dining room and the director has really not, we've seen the plates being put on the table earlier, But when you walk into that room and see it with everything there and the candles lighted, it's so warm and beautiful and the silver is shining in it, it's so attractive that you, everything of your, sorry, everything of your, your reason would just sort of fall away and you become just a potential enjoyer of that moment.
So when you make a meal for someone, that really is a gift of self, though. I mean, so often if the meal is rejected or the kids go, I don't like that. I mean, it's like, you rejected me. The food is like, I fixed this for you. So in a sense, he has given himself. Mm-hmm. And even in the buying or the acquiring of all these things. So that is saying, I give you myself. I mean, it could be.
Yeah, it could be. That.
Doesn't need to be tasted because she's saying that as a foretaste of a thing.
Yeah. Well, I think that's very true.
How many times have you taken a nice lady to a super duper restaurant?
Yeah, exactly.
And had her come in and smell.
And then walk out.
And be ready to leave. Never happened to me.
Yeah, I mean, the feast works on all our senses, and that's part of the nature of feast. It is total. It isn't just, that's why I think, you know, nothing can be worse for a cook, and I'm sure that I speak for many of you here, when you have put a lot of yourself into the thing and you put it in front of someone and they begin to talk about, oh dear, this is terrible, I'll feel so guilty, or they're wondering how many calories are in something, and you're saying, wait, no, this isn't about calories. This isn't nutrition I'm putting in. This is not just to keep you going. I mean, this is total. Certainly that's, I think Keats has caught that sense. This is way beyond what
eating.
This is a food with a lot of message weight in it, and Keats's beautiful use of language, which is probably his strongest point, is this the ability to choose just the right word. I think each of those words in that one stanza that we concentrated on and read together. And if you've ever looked at a Keats manuscript, which is fun to be able to do, you can see that he really did fuss about words. He crossed out words and put another one, and then crossed that one out and put another one, crossed that one out and put another one. Not so much because the overall concept was something he worked much at, because there's lots of gaps and inconsistencies and weird things. Keats will say one thing in one line and another thing another way. He's not a philosopher, but his care for doing the language, I think we see a beautiful example there. And it corresponds with a sense that this feast is message laden, is heavy with meaning.
You wonder if he risked his life even being there.
Poor Fred.
If he had succeeded in his journey, if he had not gone to all the trouble of this big feast, or if she had been unwilling to ride off with him.
Yeah, there's something so extravagant here that it convinces her that he must mean this. He must be serious. This is important. If it's all right with you, why don't we talk a little bit about the Dickens sections? Because I think it is not a very far step from that stanza of the Eve of St. Agnes to Dickens, the second section of Christmas Carol. From the intimacy, which is an essential part of, at least as I have set this up to in the first place, that feasting meets needs that we have as human beings, that we have a need for community, and some sorts of feasting meet that need. And we have a need for intimacy, and there is the not only the communal feast, but the intimate feast. And although that's not the usual understanding that we have of the Eucharist, there are times, I think, for each of us when that experience seems intimate one-on-one with God. I mean, usually it's true, the dimension is lateral, horizontal in communion, but and that's an important part of it. The intimacy with God at that moment is also, I think, a significant part of what we mean when we talk about that feast. But there is also in feasting the inevitable quality, and some might think of this one first, of abundance. And I think that's been true in each of the feasts that we've looked at. This one is probably one of the ones that I thought of immediately as I began thinking about feasts and books, is the second part of Christmas Carol, when Dickens does two moments of extravagant and a feast, and they're such a wonderful contrast. The first section, which is on page 6, is when Scrooge first wakes up, and he at the second visitor, the announcement of the second visitor. And his own room has undergone a surprising transformation. The walls, and I want you to think about abundance here, as Ebenezer Scrooge moves into the room where the ghost of Christmas present is waiting to welcome him. The walls and ceiling were so hung with living green that it looked a perfect grove, from every part of which bright gleaming berries glistened. The crisp leaves of holly, mistletoe, and ivy reflected back the light as if so many little mirrors had been scattered there, and such a mighty blaze went roaring up the chimney as that dull petrification of a hearth had never known in Scrooge's time or Marley's or for many and many a winter season gone. Heaped up on the floor to form a kind of throne were turkeys, geese, game, poultry, brawn, great joints of meat, suckling pigs, long wreaths of sausages, mince pies, plum puddings, barrels of oysters, red-hot chestnuts, cherry-cheeked apples, juicy oranges, luscious pears, immense 12th cakes, and seething bowls of punch that made the chamber dim with their delicious steam. In easy state upon this couch there sat a jolly giant, glorious to see, who bore a glowing torch, in shape not unlike Plenty's horn, and held it up, high up, to shed its light on Scrooge as he came peeping round the door. "Come in," exclaimed the ghost, "come in, and know me better, man." Scrooge entered timidly and hung his head before this spirit. And I always have to think, it's not before the spirit only, it's before the image of that abundance, which for Scrooge is, as we've said before about other things, it's incommensurate with his experience. For him, abundance simply does not exist. It isn't a concept. And here he sees it in actual living reality. He was not the dogged Scrooge he had been, and though the spirit's eyes were clear and kind, he did not like to meet them. "I am the ghost of Christmas present," said the spirit, "look upon me." And even as Dickens goes on with the description of Christmas present, it's a big, big figure, and its clothing is big, and its gestures are big, and its voice is loud. There's a tremendous amount of just being there. Well, that the centerpiece of the second ghost's journey for Scrooge, of course, is the Cratchit's Christmas dinner, which is a wonderful section, which anybody who has ever read it or heard it, as we do sort of endlessly in many stupid versions at Christmas time. But this, as it really exists, as Dickens wrote it, is a wonderful feast. the Cratchit's family dinner in every one of its details. We could easily spend, I think, a couple hours on this chapter, this little section by itself. Because, of course, one of the things that Dickens is doing is showing that for these people, this is a feast, although it's not abundant, although it's meager in actuality. There's only a little bit of stuff here. As this begins, on such a bustle ensued that you might have thought a goose the rarest of all birds, a feathered phenomenon to which a black swan was a matter of course. And in truth, it was something very like it in that house. The fact that they have a goose, a whole bird, was a huge luxury. But as Dickens' sentence points out, for many people, a goose was not that big a thing. It was a piece of meat that you cooked for a meal. In their house, it is rare as a black swan. And it's taken a lot of their attention. Mrs. Cratchit made the gravy, ready beforehand in a little saucepan, hissing hot. Master Peter mashed the potatoes with incredible vigor. Miss Belinda sweetened up the applesauce. Martha dusted the hot plates. Bob took Tiny Tim beside him in a tiny corner at the table. The two young Cratchits set chairs for everybody, not forgetting themselves, and mounting guard upon their post, crammed spoons into their mouths lest they should shriek for goose before their turn came to be helped. At last the dishes were set on and grace was said. It was succeeded by a breathless pause as Mrs. Cratchit, looking slowly all along the carving knife, prepared to plunge it in the breast. But when she did, and when the long-expected gush of stuffing issued forth, one murmur of delight arose all round the board, and even Tiny Tim, excited by the two young Cratchits, beat on the table with the handle of his knife and feebly cried, "Hurrah!" There never was such a goose. Bob said he didn't believe there ever was such a goose cooked. Its tenderness and flavor, size and cheapness were themes of universal admiration. Eked out by applesauce and mashed potatoes, it was a sufficient dinner for the whole family. Indeed, as Mrs. Cratchit said with great delight, surveying one small atom of a bone upon the dish, they hadn't ate it all at last. Yet everyone had had enough, and the youngest Cratchits in particular were steeped in sage and onion to the eyebrows. But now, the plates being changed by Miss Belinda, Mrs. Cratchit left the room alone, too nervous to bear witness, to take the pudding up and bring it in. This is the English cannonball Christmas pudding, steamed in a kettle outdoors for many hours. Suppose it should not be done enough. Suppose it should break in turning out. Suppose somebody should have got over the wall of the backyard and stolen it while they were merry with the goose, a supposition at which the two young Cratchits became livid. All sorts of horrors were supposed. Hello, a great deal of steam. The pudding was out of the copper. A smell like a washing day, that was the cloth. A smell like an eating house and a pastry cook's next door to each other with a laundress's next door to that. That was the pudding. In half a minute, Mrs. Cratchit entered, flushed but smiling proudly, with the pudding, like a speckled cannonball, so hard and firm, blazing in half a quartern of ignited brandy, and bedight with Christmas holly stuck into the top. Oh, a wonderful pudding, Bob Cratchit said, and calmly, too, that he regarded it as the greatest success achieved by Mrs. Cratchit since their marriage. Mrs. Cratchit said that now the weight was off her mind, she would confess she had had her doubts about the quantity of flour. Everybody had something to say about it, but nobody said or thought it was at all a small pudding for a large family. It would have been flat heresy to do so. Any Cratchit would have blushed to hint at such a thing. We could go all through the rest of it with more of the same and wonderful things. Let me ask you what you hear in that section about feasting.
Appreciation. The contrast, because there was such a great quantity in the room when Scrooge awoke, and yet the Cratchits had their feast with very little, by comparison. But it was
much more of a feast than just the quantity of food.
And Dickens makes a point of that. He doesn't want to make that the dominant feature of this scene, but he keeps putting it in there in these little sort of almost parenthetical expressions so that we don't forget that no one said it was a very small thing for such a large family. But that we know that, and Dickens wants us to know that.
I noticed the participation of the whole family in this particular compared to the one person in Babette's feast, where mm-hmm. she was doing all of the preparation. Here there is a community doing it.
Yeah, everybody in the family has something to do to get this on the table, and they're all very excited about it. Yes.
And although it was very meager, they appreciated each bit of it. I mean, everything was special, and they explained how mm-hmm. special each part was.
Yes, every piece of it is wonderful, and it seemed Dickens has here noticed such a wonderful thing, I think, that happens at family feasts, that people say, this is the best one we've ever had, you know, this is the best turkey, we never had a turkey this good, you know, I mean, you have to do that for a family feast. Or when someone makes a special dessert that gets made every year, this is the best one you've ever made, you know, you really got it perfect this time. And part of the idea of a feast is that we say those things, we communicate. That's part of our sense of appreciation, the history that dish has with us. It's our thing that we do. But this is the very best one that we've ever had. That's part of what makes it a feast. It's hard to imagine a feast where someone at least doesn't make an effort. Even if everything is a disaster, you have to say that something is just wonderful and the best ever. Just like the Christmas tree this year is the best, you know, this is the most beautiful tree we've ever had. That recognition, both of the tradition, but of the special quality of this present moment in the context of many moments, backwards and forwards, is a part of the feast.
What it says about that meal says just immense things about their usual meals.
As
you look back, if this is a meager meal, mm-hmm. and it's so special, it's so big, when you look back, why weren't there other meals that special to them? Obviously, they didn't have much.
Right.
Obviously, the special part of this was not only the meat and food, but the enjoyment of each other mm-hmm. and all of them together making it special.
Exactly. And that comes out at several points here, and when the toast is given later, when Bob makes he makes the punch for them to eat. Oh, and the Cratchit family drew round the hearth in what Bob Cratchit called a circle, meaning half a one. That somehow I do have a little remembrance there of what we often would say about an altar, that we gather around the altar, even though we're lined up in a straight line across the front. But we talk about it. We mean that this is a circle that we have. It's almost always, for most of us, it's a metaphorical circle. It's just that straight thing, and at Bob Cratchit's elbow stood the family display of glass, two tumblers and a custard cup without a handle. These are not people who live in abundance. And yet their definition of this experience is of abundance.